Hello, welcome to the Ripple of Change podcast, searching for our quadruple aim, where we highlight, celebrate, and extol others in healthcare and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Otten, and today's topic, I love this title, so buckle up, here we go. Baby boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials unite. I am joined by two agents for positive change, my guest co-host, John Silver, and guest,
Keely Gales.
John is a nurse, PhD, who loves health policy and has written really what I think is an amazing paper on healthcare delivery being a public utility. So if you're interested in that, you can definitely reach out to either one of us. And he's also one of the co-founders of nursestransforminghealthcare.org. And I want to read the mission, and I'm going to read Keely's mission too, because I think these are fantastic. To transform healthcare to a model based on wellness and disease prevention driven by nurses, which is affordable and accessible to all. And Keely also has a doctorate in physical therapy, and her organization is healthforthepeople.org with a mission statement to include all voices in healthcare reform and assist those currently left behind in order to improve quality healthcare access now and later. I'm thrilled to have you both, and I'm going to throw it over to you, John, for the first question.
Wow. Okay. So, first of all, welcome, and don't let that driven by nurses scare anybody. We're incredibly interdisciplinary, and it takes all of us to, you know, push this boulder around. So I think the first question I'd ask is, which is the first question I asked myself when I started looking at all this, is what are the goals of a healthcare system supposed to be?
For that one, John, I would default to our quadruple aim, you know, which is an evolution of the triple aim. And really, it's akin to the quintuple aim, if you think about it. Patient experience, quality care, lower costs, or fair or reasonable costs, I suppose. A lot of people don't like the P word. So I will say professional wellness, or maybe clinician wellness, or really employee wellness, human being wellness.
I thought you were going to say profit.
Well, okay. That's another P word.
P word now.
Productivity.
Oh, gosh. Oh, boy. Are you guys trying to trigger me? Is that what's going on?
No, I'm just kidding. Sorry. We'll back down.
No worries. But then you put the hour in front of it, right? And it's for all of us. And we've got to talk about health equity, too, because that's so, so important and so missing in many places. So that would be my answer. And obviously a little bit longer. And Keely, I'd love for you to maybe chime in on that as well.
Well, as I created our website and everything before I met Todd, we used the quintuple aim as our framework, which, as Todd said, is very much akin. I haven't changed it to our quadruple aim, mostly for the fact that I do love having that equity piece in there. I think that it's implied in our quadruple aim, but it's explicit in the quintuple aim. And so for me, that has a special place in my heart because, you know, I have biracial babies and I very much have lived in between worlds in many ways in my life. And I see the access issues that have existed. And that is a big driving force for me and starting this nonprofit and continuing to power through all of the difficulties of it. And I mean, that's really all there is to it. There's nothing more to add than that. You're right.
I did expand mine in the sense of, I think there's a public accountability and responsibility that healthcare has. And I think we do better when we work with people as partners. So to me, I think one of the things a healthcare system should really do is get out in front in the communities and talk to them about what are we seeing from your community? How can we work together to solve this? What kind of additional resources do you think we need? Again, that you would utilize so that we're identifying with the community as kind of a partner in addressing the actual health of the entire community, not just individual people.
I agree. And I think that I didn't say that explicitly because to me, that is part of it. I think that the beautiful news is in the last few years, there has been a much larger focus on the drivers of health, right? We're understanding that it's environmental, that there's more to it than just the doctor-patient relationship, although that is a huge part of it, as I agree with Medicine Forward, right? That is hugely important. But if we're not addressing the chemicals in the air and the water and the fact that if you can't access healthy food, how do you manage your diabetes outside of expensive medication, right? So
100%.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Keely. In fact, my wife, she'll talk about it with the kids, with, you know, being a food desert when we go to certain places, and the fact that there aren't fresh fruits and vegetables available, and how much of a blessing that is that we have access to that stuff. But for many, they don't. And it's really sad. And as John alluded to, it leads to so many health issues. Do we have it backwards, right? I mean, where should we be focusing our energy? And I jokingly say that there's whole layers of areas where we need to focus our energy to turn this ship around.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it's not really a joke. That's the thing, is that it's a yes and, right? Yep. And for a long time, I think we've been debating which is the correct approach or method for fixing healthcare. And I really see that it's a yes and. We just have to figure out how do we work together to create that change that needs to happen. So go ahead, John.
Yeah, did you ever hear the old saying that we live in a country where the health system knows very little about nutrition and the food industry could care less about our health? We have to at some point take on those food processors. And it's not a battle against the farmers. The farmers aren't the ones dumping this high fructose corn syrup and all the sugar in all our products and everything. And, you know, at some point, to me, there's a social responsibility of a health system to take on, like you said, some of these social, at least the ones a healthcare system can take on, these social and economic drivers of health. Like you said, water, air, and to me, more importantly, food.
I 100% agree. I think that one of the beauties of Health for the People is that the way that we are coming at this issue is so broad that we are welcoming those conversations with agricultural divisions, with lawyers, with a variety of individuals that all have a stake in our healthcare system, because the reality is we can't solve it alone, right? And I think that it's going to take that broad approach to make substantial change happen. So I love that idea. It just, you know, as soon as you said that, it started sparking all of these ideas or who I want to try to bring into the space to have more of these conversations, because you're 100% right. And we have in my local rural community here a really beautiful microcosm of this that I happen to be working on as well with a colleague of mine. And, you know, for example, one of our local organizations is a mushroom farm. And we talk about how do we bring in the mushroom farm when we're talking about wellness at a community level. And it really has to be both at a community level as well as at a state level and at a national level. And I think that that's one of the things I love the most about your utility approach, John, is thinking about it in that way.
Thanks.
John, do you want to expand on the utility model a little bit? I think I'm a big fan of it, too. I think it makes a lot of sense. It, you know, of course, we can't probably have the whole go over the whole paper, I suppose, because we probably don't have enough time. But do you want to hit some highlights, maybe? I think it'd be wonderful for the audience to hear a little bit more.
Sure. So the utility model solves the problem of a major social issue where we're not willing to call it a right, and we don't want to call it a privilege. So in my example, when I studied history, it was the electricity issue of the 20s that did this, because there was a group before me that talked about a utility model, but they never bothered to dive down into it to find out what had to be changed from a regular utility model, user fees, political appointee administrations, this kind of stuff. And look at what needed to be adapted in that utility model to make it work. So if you think of healthcare as a right, then we're pretty much talking about a national health system. That's going to be really the only way if we talk about a right, single payer, Medicare, whatever. If you just think of it as a privilege, then you've got to be willing to step over the dead bodies of your fellow Americans. And I don't see that as a viable option. Sorry. You know, even in the bowing down to the prophet, I just don't want to do that. So this utility model is that solution in the middle that FDR came up with to address electricity, which is also was emerging as this hugely important social thing as industry changed over to electrical devices to sell. And yet the existing power generating structures in cities were largely monopolies. They had all these LLCs over the top of them. They charged what they wanted, they went where they wanted, and they neglected a whole bunch of areas. So I think what the utility model kind of forces the system to do is address every community. The other advantage of it to me is that it avoids what I call the socialism trap in the U.S. So, you know, as I've always said, I sincerely doubt the farmer outside Muscatine, Iowa, walks into his kitchen every morning, flips the light switch on, and then shakes his fist at the sky screaming, "You damn socialists." You know, so it's a model Americans understand. We use it. It would boil down to basically a flat fee that everybody would pay. We'd all pay into it as individuals, as businesses, as cities, towns, states, the federal government, corporations. We'd all contribute in, but a lot less than we're doing now for an actual health-based system. And I think that's kind of the major advantages.
John, I think the idea is genius, and I'm very curious as to what traction it potentially could get going forward as we continue to connect these dots, you know, between individuals that want to make positive change. Keeley, did you have any thoughts on that model and how that, I'd love to hear, I can see the wheels turning, right? And so I want to hear about it.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the first person to say that you could see the wheels turning on my face. But yeah, so I love it. It's different than what I had proposed, but that's the beauty of the Health for the People plan, is that it's flexible and it is still in development, right? So what I had originally conceptualized was a marrying of the more of a national health service model, as well as restoring a free market through doing away with the insurance companies. And I know that that's not popular with everyone, but I believe that that is one of the largest drivers in the issues that we deal with in our healthcare system. And what that would allow for is there to be ingenuity in a sense where I see things like direct primary care as an example of what might expand in this model. We know that Americans like to have their choice and that they want to have the ability to pay for either faster access or what they value as better care than what might be available somewhere else. I believe that the National Health Service should provide comprehensive, equitable care. And yet there will still always be room for people to say, yes, well, I do it better. And this is why you should come to me and you should pay a little bit more. And you'll see the value in what I'm doing. And if you listen to Dr. Zev Neuwirth, he talks a lot about this concept of primary care being specialized, right? So you have this already happening, especially in, yep, Beyond the Walls. Thanks for throwing that up there. He's great. And this concept that, you know, geriatrics really needs to have more of a holistic approach, and they need to have providers and wraparound care around that. And another population that's talked about a lot is, you know, people with chronic conditions, right? Mm-hmm. Diabetes, high blood pressure, et cetera. I happen to work with a population that is also specialized, that's EDS and hypermobility syndromes, who often come with a host of other comorbidities, including mast cell activation syndrome, POTS, et cetera. And so I see this model as a way to help those special populations get even better healthcare, because we would naturally start to form these coalitions between different providers who specialize in those areas and create care homes as a way to think about it. But not to mean they can't go anywhere else. It just means that they can pay maybe $50 a month over what they're paying for the National Health Service through their taxes or through some utility sense to get that extra level of care and know that their providers are truly interdisciplinary and meeting and talking about their cases. So I don't think it's a far stretch to go from what I was originally conceptualizing to what John's talking about. I think that there's a way to marry either of them. And honest to God, I don't care. Whatever works and whatever makes sense for people is what we need to do. And that's why I have proposed this 15-point plan, but it's so broad that the goal is to bring people in and have these beautiful conversations with that diverse understanding so we can get to the root of what is the best.
I've got my mouth open, but I'm not saying anything because that was so good. There's so many things I want to piggyback on that. It's just brilliant. And I think maybe the most important part of that is the concept of it, at least in my humble opinion, is working together. You know, there's many of us out there that want to improve the existing landscape, and it doesn't have to be just one idea. You know, the conglomeration of these thought processes and ideas, there's magic in there. There really is. And I think we're on the cusp of really starting to make some change in that regard. Just for the listeners, though, I will throw out the acronyms out there for EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and POTS. Interestingly enough, when I was in medical school, I don't even remember going over that. Postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which can be very problematic for people for sure. So did I get all the acronyms, Keely?
I spelled out MCAS already, so I think we're good.
All right, cool. You know, this is a fantastic discussion. Why don't I throw a little bit of a curveball in here? And I will do a ripple challenge question. For the audience, this is just a random question. I basically get to do whatever I want and see where it takes us. So, what is your favorite type of music, John?
Wow, because I am really eclectic. My brother and I have over 860 LPs, going back to original Beatles stuff. So, you know, I started off, of course, in the 60s, but I got, let me give a brief answer. A lot. I just recently rediscovered the Talking Heads. I kind of blew by them in the 80s because I'd kind of given up on a lot of the music at that time. It seemed so commercial. And I rediscovered them, you know, and I really like them, but I like the swing rock, things like Tower Emerald and, you know, Tape 5 and some of these wild groups. And you know, I also go back to the Flying Burrito Brothers and the country rock hybrids from the 60s and 70s.
John, were you just making up the Flying Burrito Brothers, or is that real?
No. The guy's name is Graham Parsons.
Oh, geez. This shows you what I know about pop culture. Like, half the things you just said were like right over my head.
No. They were fantastic. They were. if you don't mind a little country swing in your rock.
I'm going to have to check it out. How about you, Keely? What would you say?
Yeah, I have a hard time answering that directly as well. I actually had this conversation with a patient yesterday, and I realized that what I really like is the lyrics. So regardless, it's the lyrics and melody for me. The music is wonderful, and I appreciate musicians. I think the sad thing about really good musicians is that you don't notice them when they're doing their job well. It's almost like things are just seamless as far as instrumentalists. But I love everything from country to rap, hip hop, R&B. Americana is the thing I listen to the most. I have to be careful to play music in the clinic that I don't know. Otherwise, I will accidentally sing along with it. So I try to spare my patients from that.
They might enjoy it. You might be surprised, right? John, you're probably not going to like my default. I always go back to the hair bands from the 80s when I'm trying to relive my youth, I suppose. But I think there is an interesting one that I really caught on to recently, mainly because of the lyrics. When I was finishing editing and writing the book, I came across this band called Porcupine Tree. And the song that really gravitated with me was Arriving Somewhere, But Not Here. And I was like, wow, this kind of encapsulates where I'm at in my transition with my career. And really, if you think about it, it encapsulates a little bit of what we're talking about with our healthcare system, right? Where are we going? Well, we don't all know necessarily, but we sure know that the current state of things is not ideal. So I'm loving this conversation. This is brilliant. And I'm glad the two of you are giving such wonderful answers, and I can mainly be quiet as usual. John, do you maybe have another question or two, and we can dig into things a little bit more?
Yeah, I think what would be in your minds, because I definitely have my opinion, of the ideal administrative structure or whatever we co-create in healthcare. In other words, what we've got now are people that are very vested in kind of self-interest of profit maximization, because that's their job and that's what keeps them making the money and gets them the stock bonuses and all that stuff. If we're going to replace that with something, and I think we have to, what kind of structure, and like when I talk about the utility model, I talk about, you know, nursing's role. And the reason I thought that nursing should be the chair of this interdisciplinary council is because the nursing focus is in our code of ethics is on a bigger picture than just this patient in this bed. So I thought keeping that system focused on this holistic view of health in every community, not just, you know, the ones that have insurance or the ones that have money, was critical. But I'd really love to get your feedback on what you think that administrative structure should look like.
I'll take that one first, if you don't mind. It's something that I've thought a lot about, and part of why I advocate for a single payer system, because I believe that it is done better, while not perfectly, in countries that already have a single payer system. And I think that one unique thing about Americans is, for better or worse, we take things that other countries have done pretty well and we make them our own and sometimes make them better. And so I think that if we put our heads together, we could figure out how to improve upon that model of single payer, where we create some more checks and balances around making sure that people still have the access that they need. I know that that's a big concern for people that, oh, well, qualities might go down, or the ability to access the care they need in a timely manner might worsen, which, by the way, it's not good right now. Market forces are not protecting that, just in case anyone is disillusioned or of the illusion that that's not an issue currently. 6 months to get in to see a specialist in my area, where we have three major teaching hospitals, is, you know, still an issue. So I think that having one part of that is like a check and balance at the national level, as well as at the state level, and possibly also at the local level, where there is a board or a commission, if you will, that's very multidisciplinary and includes patient advocates, 50% non-providers or non-clinicians, if we don't use the P word, who are there to balance and make sure that we are not just doing what serves the purposes of the health system or of potentially only the clinicians, and loses the patient perspective. And I think that that type of model could be productive at the national, at the state, and even at the regional level. John's model discusses using, like, a, for example, I'm in Chapel Hill, right? So I think about it, UNC is the big teaching hospital in my area, and having that kind of be the hub of how we negotiate things in our region. And I think that it's a decent approach. I don't know that I have a better one, but either way, I still think that even UNC has problems on its board, right? We need to make sure that that board represents diverse perspectives. And I think that that could go down to the hospital level as well, you know, that our administrators need to be intentionally looking at the viewpoints of all stakeholders. And that helps create another level of check and balance to whether people want to make more money or provide more care. And hopefully at that level, if we're talking about it regionally, we can be really talking about the drivers of health in that community as well. And how do we improve the community of the health as a whole in order to maybe make more profit? I think the discussion around profit is the interesting part, and people don't always love the concept of value-based care. But I think that if done correctly, and it has been done well in certain places, there are examples of how it can be done well, that switching to a value-based model is going to be part of how do we change the administration as well.
That was brilliant. There is so much to unpack in both of what you just said. I love it. I love getting patients higher up in, from an advocacy perspective and also a decision-making perspective. I think that's genius. And the reality is it would point out a lot of the flaws in the system, the hospital, the office, regardless of the level. I mean, if you just listen to the patients, they'll tell you where the problems are at. When I was chief of staff, I would get a ton of feedback. You know, I didn't need a survey. I just needed to listen to the people telling me where the problems were and then bring it to the medical executive committee to deal with it. It worked so, so well. And John, I agree with you that we need clinicians at the highest levels. You know, I'll make a bad joke here. I mean, I've got a nurse that runs my household and it goes pretty well. And I'm the physician, so obviously it's not me. kudos to my wife. She does a great job. But there are examples out there too, to go back to what Keely said, where you have a national system with sort of that pay up component to it, if you will. Singapore is one of those such examples. Why can't we look at that and potentially extrapolate some of those ideas and bring it over here? Just a thought, random thought for sure.
I only have one big issue with single payer. And it goes back to an old saying, which is he who pays the fiddler calls the tune. It's an old saying, I know. Well, I'm old, too bad. So the question to me is, and what I'm really talking about here is patient data and patient information. The thing that sunk Clinton's healthcare plan in 94 when she tried to bring it out was the Harry and Louise ads, where these couples going, you know, I don't want the federal government knowing what my healthcare information is. That's a potential abuse to them. And even though the government knows everything else about you, I can kind of see that, you know, I don't want the government knowing what people's mental health problems are or what their disabilities might be, or unless there's a specific need to have that. So to me, that's the only really huge argument against single payer, is that, you know, they're going to decide what's covered. They're going to decide what's going to be allowed because they're paying the bill.
Yeah, it's so, an interesting point. Go ahead, Keely.
I have two potential solutions for that, and they're not my solutions, but one of them is, I'm terrible with names, so forgive me, but I can get the information and send it to you, Todd, if you want to link it. But there is a gentleman who's created a plan for the individual owning their health information. So rather than the hospital having, you know, ownership of your information, you as the individual have that ownership and you give your providers access to it when you choose them as a provider. And that way, even potentially in a national system, you have more control over your health information. And I think that that is a potential solve for that. The other thing that I'll bring back up is just having that check and balance at the national level. And part of the way I've conceptualized that thus far is it being a precursor to Congress. So for example, if there's any legislation that a congressperson might want to put forward, it has to go through this, I call it the Health Oversight Commission, first. And they would have to debate it and vote on it before it could ever be discussed at Congress. And so at least you have this multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, including patient advocates group that is looking at those things before they get changed. And as a check and balance on that he who pays the fiddler, right?
This is so good. So good. So many good ideas here. Such a wonderful conversation. We could go on for probably hours, if not days, talking about this. One comment regarding ownership of data and stuff. I think this is where blockchain technology may play a big role in solving that particular problem. You know, cryptographic, what have you, and I'm not an expert there. I know just enough to be dangerous, probably. But there was one question I would feel remiss if we didn't hit it before we wrap this up, and it came from Keely. My daughter, who's 9, it might be a Swiftie. And I'm not necessarily a Swiftie, but I actually recognize this lyric because I really like the song Anti-Hero for whatever reason. That's where this came from, right? Right, Keely?
It is. I have to give her all the credit.
So I'm not going to try and sing this, but I am going to say the lyric and then look for maybe both of you to chime in on it a little bit. And we'll start with you, Keely. It's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me.
Yeah, man, there's so many layers to this quote. One is something, Todd, that I know you and Gabe have talked a lot about, which is taking ownership that we as clinicians are part of the problem and making sure that we are part of the solution. I think that the other thing is, in my mind, getting out of the way of progress. So the example I use for this, if you have been listening much about the push for ranked choice voting, right? Mm-hmm. I think that that is an amazing solution. And what it does is it allows the possibility for more political parties and therefore more opinions and better solutions, in my view. I think that that's the only way that we can get to the point where we can have a third party that's viable. You know, right now, I hate to say it because there's lots of individuals who might be independent or Green Party or something in between that might be better candidates than who we currently have as options, but they're not an option because we are so steeped in this two-party system. So our belief that the third party can't get anywhere is what's keeping the third party from getting anywhere. Like, that's what it all boils down to. I know that's a roundabout way of getting there. But the point is, it's the same thing as far as doing comprehensive healthcare reform. The belief that it's too big, that it's too complicated, that there's too many people with deep pockets that are going to shut it down is the thing that's keeping it from getting anywhere. And my answer to that is they are powerful, but we are many. And I really believe that we're at a unique moment in time right now where clinicians, providers, whatever you want to call them, and patients are equally pissed off. And it's an opportunity for us to come together and work together and bring in all those other voices that I've discussed as well to create this radical change that needs to happen.
John, would you like to?
Oh, that was potent.
You can always tell, like, when I'm starting to get antsy in my chair, I want to chime in. Go ahead, John. Sorry.
I would tell you that that's a great quote from Ms. Swift. You know, I have great admiration for her, by the way. And I think all of us as disciplines have to accept this too. We've become so siloed. And in a lot of cases, it boils down to basically hubris of thinking that only we have the solutions, you know, like public health, only we have the solution for rural community health. Or, and I think medicine suffers this too, this inability to work as partners with other people versus the, you know, I'm the authority on all things healthcare and everybody has to do what I say. Because it is going to take all of us to do this. The opposing team, shall we say, is putting anywhere from $100 million to $300 million a year into the legislative process to block innovation, to keep their money siphons in place.
Keep the status quo.
Yeah. And so it is going to take us working together, but I want to get away from this subservience and start, let's start talking to each other as partners in how we can do this, because we each have a role to play. In my discipline, nursing, actually the people who call themselves the leadership are actually the biggest part of the problem. We've become a fractured field, and the facility type leaders, the national leader things are really subsidiaries of the American Hospital Association. The American Nurses Association has hardly any membership, 4%. And it's because they're not putting out an aggressive projection of what they think nursing should evolve into. What is our role? They are also kind of just following this preordained plan of, you know, who's the boss, how things work, and we're just, how do we niche in somewhere at the process level to do something? And so I think we need visionaries that can unite these fields with something we can get behind.
Oh, this is so fantastic. It so goes with the title of this episode, to be honest with you. I did that as a little bit of a joke, you know, but I thought it would catch people's attention. But I mean, I think it speaks that we've got to work together. You know, we have three different disciplines in this conversation here, three different age brackets, but all with the same notion that we can work together to get to a better place. And there are entities out there working on this. I think of the work Denise Wiseman and Lonnie Hirsch are doing with the Healthcare Reinvention Collaborative, trying to connect these dots. And yes, there's going to have to be some give and take. 100%. You know, we can't just use one modus operandi to get us there. It's going to take a village, if you will. I think we've kind of hit our time here. And I want to offer each of you maybe one more plug, if you will, or something you'd like to impart to the audience, or both. But I always will give my little plug, and I suppose I should hold up a book for once. I always do that. So here's my book, Ripple of Change, written with a patient, tons of places to get it. Also, all three of us are involved with medicineforward.org, gaining a lot of traction. There are some wonderful positive change agents there. Please come check us out. John, why don't you go first? We'll hear some plugs from you, maybe one final thought, and then we'll wrap it up.
I was looking for my Ripple of Change copy because you promised to sign it for me whenever we met.
Well, we could have Keely go first. There's no set rules to this.
We formed Nurses Transforming Healthcare a couple of years ago. But the mission of it has always been to get empowered to the point where we can go into the public domain and present this option to the American public, because all we've had are really three visions presented politically, which is, you know, stab the PPACA to death until we kill it, incrementally improve it over 20 or 30 years, or Medicare for all. And there are other options that I think the American public could get behind and understand. You know, I've talked to red and blue groups. 20% of the red crowd goes running out of the room with their hair on fire. But the rest of them sit there and listen and go, shit, this makes a lot of sense. Why are we paying so much and all that?
John, you're okay with that slip there.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not a very cursing kind of person, but I was
terrified. When you're passionate about something, you know, it just comes out sometimes.
So again, our goal has always been just to get empowered enough ourselves where we can break into like major podcasters or national media or something where we can sit down and have a discussion, because what we're talking about here with the utility model is not a meme. You know, it's not a bumper sticker. It will require a discussion. I know Mr. Trump found out that healthcare is complex. Yeah, it is, but it has solutions.
Well said, sir. Keely.
Yeah.
Your turn.
I agree. I think that Health for the People was formed because the solutions exist, and they're even proven. That's the beauty of it, is at this moment in time, they're out there. We just don't know about them, and we just haven't decided which ones and how do we fit them together. And I love the work that Denise is doing on that. And the way I view Health for the People is it's just that ever-present room where everybody can be a part of the conversation. And we can talk about it from a really broad, really high level and figure out maybe how do we organize, how do we get all of these change leaders to figure out which part they can specialize in, but not let it be separate from the whole, right? And so we formulate these conversations in a different kind of silo. Rather than it being based on your designation, it's based on the solution. And I've proposed 15 solutions, but that's just to have a framework. If at the end of the day, everyone in the conversation says, no, what we need to do is we need to do John's model. I'm here for it. Like, let's change the conversation. You know, that's the beauty, is that people have the power in our space. All the people actually have power in the drawing room. So my plug is go to healthforthepeople.org and click on that contribute link on the home page, and it'll take you to the drawing room. Join the drawing room. It's very inexpensive. And I just want people to be in there having this conversation.
This is music to my ears. I thank you both for joining the show today. And I'm glad and proud to call you both friends. And one final thought, what positive ripple of change will you create today?
Grab your copy today. Ripple of Change is available in hard, soft, and ebook formats. More information at www.ourquadrupleaim.com. Thanks for listening, and let's turn ripples into waves of lasting change. Stay tuned to this podcast as we search for examples of our quadruple aim.